Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. As with us, as always, is the venerable Michael Hamilton. Michael, how are you this afternoon?
I'm awesome, mate. Very good.
Excellent. Now, I'm really excited because today we've got Ty Miller. Now, Ty is the Managing Director of Threat Intelligence. He is one of the APAC leaders when it comes to security, cybersecurity, penetration testing, anything to do in that sector, you name it. Ty's probably been doing it for a long time and probably taught half of APAC how to do it. So, Ty, thank you very much for joining us, mate. Welcome aboard.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mate, always, always. So tell us a bit about how you started in the cybersecurity game. I know that you sort of dabbled a bit in university, but Tell us the tale about how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, look, I actually started my career straight into security. So I became the security officer for Macquarie Uni. And basically, back then, this was early 2000s, we had no security in the uni. There was no visibility of attacks. There were no firewalls. So pretty much, and that's sort of why a lot of universities these days have public IP addresses on their internal networks and own like one or two class Bs because they just had nothing. They had no firewalls. So I ended up having to teach myself how to hack back then, because I was allowed to hack into anything in the uni, taught myself how to hack, basically had the goal of getting the vice chancellor's tax file number and going and handing that to her. That basically ended up in a budget of about $5 million to build our first data center, and went and built the first data center for the uni and started migrating all of their systems in there. And at that point, there was a couple of startups of penetration testing companies around. So I went and became the CTO of Pure Hacking back then. And I was the CTO there for about 9 years before starting up Threat Intelligence. And throughout that period, because I was in the pen testing industry quite early, and there was only really a handful of guys around back then who actually did this sort of thing, whereas these days there's so many people who sort of dabble in it at least. Got very involved with Black Hat. Started doing presentations over at Black Hat, been going to Black Hat and to Vegas for every year for I think the last 15 years, which... definitely, the shine wears off after the first couple of years of going there, and I end up spending just a couple of weeks inside a hotel room or at least the casino, inside the casino. So, basically I got very involved in Black Hat, on the Black Hat Asia review board. So we're just kicking that off for this year. And about to review all of the presentations that come through, which is really awesome because you get to see, some of the pre-release attacks and some of the new attacks and vulnerabilities that come out and some of the tools that are coming out before they actually get released, which is always good to see. And been presenting there since 2008 and also been running training as well as our team over at Black Hat USA and Europe for the last 10 years.
Amazing career. I mean, and I guess when it comes to Black Hat, that's the one conference, I guess, where no one really connects to the Wi-Fi, right? That was like kind of the rule of thumb back there as well.
Yeah, you keep your laptop off, you turn your phone off. I mean, DEF CON's definitely much more malicious than, Black Hat. Black Hat, you still have, guys walking around in polo shirts, whereas at DEF CON, you've basically got, tats, black shirts, pretty much everything as dark as you can possibly get. But, those guys hack into the air conditioning, into the ATMs, into the TVs, into the poker machines. They just don't hold back. So
it's pretty crazy. I mean, I guess for the average punter on the street, I mean, this stuff is so prevalent, but a lot of it is so under the covers, isn't it? So is a lot of the work that you do also, I guess, an education forefront, you know, when you're going presenting about, you know, what the vulnerabilities are and what's coming and what people need to do to kind of guard against that?
Yeah, look, a lot of the stuff that we do at Black Hat is much more advanced stuff. So we're training up the likes of the FBI, US Department of Defense, US military, international government agencies, and all those big technology and security companies like FireEye, Tripwire, Juniper, Cisco, Palo Alto, you know, Akamai, Yahoo, all those sort of places. So, you know, and you tend to have some of the more mature sort of students on the course, not all of them, but a good portion. So you tend to be teaching much more advanced techniques. So things like the Shellcode Lab, which we've been running for the last 10 years. And I think it's one of the longest, if not the longest running training course at Black Hat USA. And yeah, that teaches guys how to write backdoors in assembly for Mac, Linux and Windows on 32-bit and 64-bit architectures and integrate them into exploits to break into more stuff. And not surprisingly, that's the one that, you know, you get the FBI and those sort of guys coming on to, you know, increase their exploitation capabilities. So sorry to everyone about that, but but yeah, and but I mean, we do security awareness training, and quite often I actually get asked to do that for our clients, just because I've got so many war stories that you can sort of bring up, and it really just drives it home to try and get that awareness out. I don't know how effective it is. I mean, they all seem to be really, after the training, they really want to make a change. But, you know, even when we've been through some of the security awareness, we actually combine with phishing attacks, so we're like, and social engineering attacks. So we'll go do a whole series of phishing attacks against the company and social engineering attacks against the company Well, we do it after the training to see if they fall for it, and we still get them, right? So it's one of those things with end user education. I think, you know, it's just a matter of getting, you only need one to actually break into a company. One of the ones that we did, I think that may have been one of those where out of, I think there was a more advanced attack technique that they got us to do. And out of, I think, 500, so this was for endpoint exploitation, so not just phishing to get them to click on a link or to type in their username and password, it was actually to compromise their machine. And out of something like 500 people who we targeted, there's something like 180 of them who put the backdoor on their machine. So.
Well, because I guess that is the big problem, right? For all the technical advancements we're making to sort of stop things, the most targeted area on most attacks really is the human psyche and human behavior, isn't it, in order to then get that exploit working?
Yeah. Well, like it's changed over the years. So it's one of the really interesting things that I think, you know, that our team have a lot of insights with, because, you know, we only hire guys who have, you know, sort of like 15 years worth of security experience. So they've all been around for a while. So they've seen everything change from, you know, sort of early 2000s and seen all of the different evolutions of the hacking industry and things come through. So like if you go back to the early 2000s, you tend to see, you know, a lot of infrastructure-based attacks. Where, you know, they're attacking things like your mail servers and your web servers and your DNS servers and anything that's exposed to the internet. And as some of the security or the IT companies or technology companies like Microsoft, as well as some of the open source platforms within Linux and things, actually start investing really heavily in their technology, and you know, Windows has put massive amounts of security into their operating system, their platform over the years. You know, you started to see a lot of those external vulnerabilities start to drop off, and you actually saw a lot of the exploit writers actually shift from direct exploitation of infrastructure to client-side exploits. So things like, you know, your web browser or your Microsoft Office and those sort of things. And that was actually why around that time when I did my first presentation at Black Hat, that was on reverse DNS tunneling shellcode, which was to basically improve the capabilities of client-side exploits to break out of an organization. So back then it was in like the, you know, Internet Explorer 6 days, and you know, you had to have to do that client-side exploitation, and a lot of them used proxy, like going over HTTP tunneling, but they were really unreliable because they relied on you having IE6, you had to have your proxy configured, you have to have your credentials saved in there for it to even get close to working. And if you didn't have any of that, you know, the whole thing just broke. Whereas the, and you also had like the web content filtering to be able to filter out some of that stuff. Whereas with the DNS tunneling, it was a bit slower, but it just meant that basically it bypassed all of those controls and went through your internal, you know, DNS out to the internet. And yeah, that ended up, so I presented that, and then I started the shellcode lab off the back of that. And then core security, who have the Core Impact commercial exploitation framework, actually came and saw me at Black Hat 1 year and got me to go and develop that for them for their Core Impact platform. So develop their Core Impact covert DNS tunneling payload. And that's, yeah, by far the smallest payload that they've got within their within the software, which means that every exploit basically, you know, can fit the payload in it to break into more stuff.
Fantastic. That's awesome. It wouldn't be a question in 2020 about COVID. So what sort of security threats have you seen because of COVID this year? Anything that stands out?
Yeah, absolutely. Massive amount. So the when COVID really kicked in sort of in, say, March, and everyone started, you know, working from home and those sort of things, and that big rush, you know, I said to the guys that within 3 months you're going to be absolutely flat out, because what happens from COVID is that, and we saw this in the GFC as well, where it triggered and escalated the financial crisis, which then triggers an increase in crime, because people start to struggle financially and therefore, you know, turn to the dark side basically. And these days it's cybercrime. So when you have a look at, you know, the UN came out and said last year, I think it was, or the year before, that $2 trillion are being laundered of cybercrime every year. And that's typically through things like, you know, your Bitcoin, as well as in-app purchases for mobiles. But that $2 trillion is a huge motivation for people who are struggling financially, right? So, you know, when you've got that huge financial motivation in an economic crisis, and you've got a low chance of actually getting caught because of the international scale of cybercrime, you know, it's a no-brainer for some of these people just to turn to, you know, turn to the bad side and just start breaking into people. So, or into organizations, really. So historically, if you go back sort of that 10 years, you would have seen sort of 5 to 10 years, you would have seen sort of the individual ransomware style attacks. And I mean, they're not small amounts of money what they're bringing in. These are, you know, they tend to bring in between $100 to $150 million every year for each of those campaigns. So it's a $1 billion industry, the ransomware side of things. But what we've seen with COVID sort of kicking things off, we've seen a massive, probably from about mid-June this year, just saw just security breach after security breach after security breach. And these were not just, you know, your typical sort of drive-by attacks. These were actually targeted infiltrations of major organizations. They're working their way through their systems and escalating their privileges without getting caught, and then basically encrypting every server globally within the organizations, and then holding them to ransom, not for, you know, $4,000 or $20,000, it's, you know, $3 to $6 million that they're holding him ransom for. So that's really been the big shift that we've seen in some of the threat landscape over the last 6 months, and it's just hasn't stopped. It's just been attacks and security breaches. You know, we just had two additional ones come up this week. So it's interesting times for sure.
I guess the other thing as well is it's not just, you know, your average organization, but we've seen a huge increase in regards to, well, they say state-sponsored, and I'll use those quotes because, again, that's very, very difficult to kind of prove. But, I mean, you've been working directly also with our local government based on, you know, some attacks that have happened earlier this year, and there's been an increase in global state-sponsored attacks between each other. So is this kind of the new way of countries probing each other out without, you know, disputing things the old-fashioned way, you know, with tanks and artillery?
Yeah, look, I mean, this, you know, that's been going on forever, right? You know, there was, if you go back a while again, and when WikiLeaks was really sort of the big talking point, and a lot of those US governments were coming out around that sort of Snowden time, there was a lot of interviews with, you know, especially US government officials, and there was one interview that I can't remember who it was with, but I distinctly remember him saying, you know, everyone, all of the governments are hacking each other. You know, every ally is hacking each other's allies because that's how we build up the trust with each other. So if I don't hack into you, I can't trust, you know, you can't trust what governments are saying, right? It's basically marketing. You know, so if I don't hack into you, then I can't trust you, right? So, you know, that stuff's been going on forever. There's been, you know, hacking into, you know, internet routers of countries for years. So all of that stuff isn't really new. You know, there's even, you know, the Snowden movie about it that went into pretty good detail about things. Seems a bit scary, but yeah, look, I mean, in that space, you know, I don't think a lot has changed, to be honest. That's sort of just continuing as normal. I think just some of the capabilities, I think, are increasing over time, as you would expect. You know, there was the NSA breach where they had all of their hacking tools stolen, and pretty much every penetration testing company got excited and went and got a copy of those. You know, even those, like all of the governments come out and say, you know, it's a sophisticated attack, you know, and when Scott Morrison came out and said that there was a national cyber attack going on towards the end of June, you know, it was, oh, there's not many countries that have these capabilities. You know, it's only, you know, a handful of them. And we were actually investigating that security breach a week before he announced that. So we had a really good insight into some of the attacks and things that were going on and the techniques that the attackers were using. But I mean, before we knew there was a national cyber attack going on, we were investigating it, and we were sort of laughing at some of these techniques that these guys were using. So, you know, it was like, why would you go and do that? That's a stupid way of doing it, you know? And so when the client was asking us, you know, is this a state-sponsored attack, because it was relevant for them that it could potentially be, and we said, no, this is definitely not state-sponsored. It's more likely to be a bit of a script kiddie, you know, doing some of this stuff. And then Scott Morrison came out and he started announcing all of that, and he's like, oh, this is very sophisticated. And before the details had come out, I was like, oh, that's definitely not what we're doing, what we're looking at the moment. And when they released, the ACSC released all of the indicators of compromise with a really good analysis of the attack and really good breakdown. So, you know, hats off to them to put that level of detail out. Yeah, we looked through that document and we're like, yeah, this is exactly what we're seeing. That doesn't match up with Scott Morris, what, you know, the PM was saying, right? So, you know, when these guys come out and say, you know, the US, for example, saying, oh, China's hacking us and all this sort of stuff, you got to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt, because, you know, attributing these attacks to anyone really, really difficult.
Well, US government officials, when I see on like CNN or whatever channel I'm watching, they're so casual. They've done it again. They tried hacking us. And they mentioned, it's just hilarious. It makes me laugh when I watch it.
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time, right? Like, and it's not just against governments. It's against anyone. Like, if you put in a next-gen firewall, you know, in front of your network and you look at it for 5 seconds, you're probably going to have 1,000 attacks against you. You know, like, these aren't, you know, they're just constant. It's part of being on the internet.
Very much like that. Obviously, the private sector, like when people do get hacked, for example, I know you've heard about there's a customer service line on the other side, like very casual.
Yeah.
Oh, you've been hacked and can you give us some money? Is that the type of things you see a lot regularly?
Yeah, look, I mean, we don't tend to call it a service line, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, some of these guys, like I was saying, it's a $1 billion industry. Some of these campaigns bring in $150 million a year. So it's in these are big business, you know, like if you have a company that's pulling in $150 million a year, it's pretty sophisticated operation, right? So you have to put that into perspective with these guys that they're a business, you know, they've got the same sort of issues that any enterprise would have. And one of those is customer service, getting customers to pay. And at the end of the day, their ransomware victims are their customers. So, you know, when you're dealing with, especially with those endpoint, sort of the individual ransomware victims rather than enterprises, you know, you've got, you know, mums and dads and, you know, people who aren't necessarily IT literate who would have no idea how to go and buy Bitcoin, you know, and let alone get it in time for, you know, their files to be decrypted. So, you know, they need assistance to do it. And it's in the interest of the attackers to actually give them assistance to, you know, make sure that they're going to get their money. So, you know, there's a lot of, when you pay the ransoms, you do get your files back. And, you know, some of these chat lines, you know, you can say, you know, express your concerns. Oh, well, what if I pay you the money and, you know, I don't get my files back? You know, how do I know that you can actually decrypt my files? And they'll actually say, look, as a sign of good faith, we'll give you two of your files back to show that, you know, we can do it. You know, if it doesn't work, we'll give you your money back, you know, all of that sort of thing. And, you know, it just helps to, strangely enough, build confidence between the victim and the attacker, sort of like that Stockholm syndrome in a cyber sort of way.
But it is, isn't it? It's human psychology really working and trying to, you know, manipulate the people into thinking, oh, look, and you're right, it's almost like any business. If you're going to demand someone gives you, you know, 3 Bitcoin for, well, given the current price, there's like 60 grand or something, right? So yeah. If they don't have the access and you're constantly wiping someone's files, that's not good business practice, right? You're going to need to learn on how to recover from your investment. But speaking of that, from an investment point of view, I guess one of the big things that makes this attractive is the barrier to entry is so low, right? I mean, all you need really is a decent working PC and internet connection. Mm-hmm. And there are so many tools and sites available now on via open source that this isn't as, you know, back in the day, okay, you've always had your script kiddies, but it's kind of become a lot more accessible for different types of attacks now, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you look back, you know, in the early 2000s again, I mean, there were no hacking or very, very few good hacking tools around. So you really had to do penetration testing, for example, or to do hacking. You actually had to know what you were talking about. You now had to know how to do the attacks, you know, quickly write some programs to put it together. You know, like for those who know Metasploit, I mean, Metasploit wasn't even around, you know, back then. So that kicked off, I think it was around sort of 2004, I think. So before then, you know, you didn't even have that. Whereas these days, it's, you know, some of this stuff's a piece of cake. You know, you go and download, you know, multiple different open source exploit kits. You know, you've got GitHub, which is pretty much your hacking toolkit for pretty much anything that you want to do, and you just download it and run it. So, you know, the ability to, you know, go and break into companies or individuals is, the barrier is really, really low to actually get started. You know, like people have said to me, oh, you know, like North Korea, they wouldn't have the resources to go and do this. I'm like, they don't have laptops in North Korea. Like, what are you talking about?
Yes, well, it's always comforting to know Michael, if the podcast doesn't work out, he can pick up a career very quickly, you know, via tools of the internet. So there you go, Michael, penetration testing.
No, I've noted that down.
Absolutely. Now, the one thing I wanted to also talk about, Ty, was obviously you guys are building the Evolve platform, which is kind of, I guess, you know, managed security for companies that don't have internalized security departments. So do you want to tell us a bit about how that works as well?
Yeah, sure. So it's a little bit different to managed security. I mean, we do offer it as managed service, but it's actually a SaaS platform where you can actually enhance the capabilities of your team itself. So the problem that really pretty much every government and organization and SMB has globally around the world is that security is an expense, which means that your security budgets are going to be limited, especially right now with COVID accelerating that global economic crisis. Everyone's trying to tighten up their budgets to fit in with that drop with some companies with the revenues. But then, as we were saying, the actual threats against the companies have increased. So it's a really difficult position for companies to be in, where they're having to tighten up their purses whilst they've got an increase of attacks. So, you know, what we're trying to solve is that with that limited budgets, that tends to mean that you've got limited security teams, so small security teams. When you have a small security team, that tends to mean that you've got generalist security guys who, that's not a bad thing. It means that they have capabilities to be able to manage everything across the organization, but that tends to mean that they've got they don't necessarily have that really deep technical capability for security, but they've got that capability to manage a broad set. And what that means when they don't have those deep technical capabilities is that when things like they suffer a security breach, you know, they don't know what to do with it. You know, they might have a look around on the system a bit, and if they don't see anything, you know, that pops out immediately, you know, they run their own antivirus over it and it doesn't flag anything, they give it a green light, which is not the way that it works. You know, like going, you know, to do that proper incident response, you need to be able to know how to go and do memory dumps and what evidence to collect. So things like your running processes, your network connections, your registry hives, your log files, your user accounts, your services, your master file table, you know, your kernel drivers, all of that sort of stuff. And even a lot of security professionals, you know, and security specialists actually don't know that level of detail that they actually need to go to. So in one of our training courses at Black Hat, there's one called Automating Security with Open Source, and just trying to teach people how, like, the different concepts of how to actually automate security and what they can automate. And one of those parts is automating your incident response. And so I surveyed all of my students. There was about 120 or 140 students one year across Black Hat USA and Black Hat Europe, and went through the whole, got them to put their hand up. Everyone put their hand up at the start, got them to put their hand down if they didn't have an incident response procedure, got them to put their hand down if they didn't have a team who actually knew how to execute the incident response procedures, if they didn't know how to go and what evidence to collect, whether they could do a memory dump, whether they could analyze the memory dump to identify malicious processes and extract those, how to create indicators of compromise to identify those and search the rest of their systems for their IOCs and actually contain the breach. And not a single person across those Black Hat Europe and Black Hat USA, out of those 140 Black Hat students, was able to actually do it end to end. So that just gives you a bit of an insight into, you know, when no securities professionals in those courses actually knew how to do that, have those security capabilities. It just goes to show that with all these security breaches that are going on, it's no surprise why, you know, these breaches aren't getting detected, or, you know, they come back again and again. So what we're trying to do with Evolve is actually, in a cost-effective way, give them on-demand access to these deep technical security capabilities. So what we've done is we've hired top-notch guys who we've brought in from around the world. We've then codified their knowledge and their experience into automation modules and automation workflows. And then we've made them available in the Evolve marketplace. So coming back to Evolve, it's basically the world's first security automation cloud. So if you think about AWS and Azure from an infrastructure cloud perspective, Evolve is dedicated to security automation. So we've got regions in Australia, the US and Europe. And you can basically, go and get capabilities for your team on demand. So if you think that, you know, you've got a generalist set of guys within your organization and you need to maximize your security budgets whilst also maximizing your limited resources and their capabilities, you can say, all right, instead of going and spending, you know, my 100 grand or 200 grand or whatever your penetration testing budget is, which sort of shoots ourselves in the foot a little bit because we offer those services. But, you can now go to Evolve and go to the marketplace and say, all right, I want my team to have that capability, import automated penetration testing. Now my team has that capability. And you can, your team can, you know, by filling in six fields, say, all right, go and run a penetration test and schedule it for once a month, you know, for an external pen test, go and run an internal pen test once a month. And have that run every month. You know, go and hook it into my DevOps pipeline and have that automatically, test my applications, have that, you know, up and running. So, there's basically sort of five pillars. There's automated penetration testing. There's automated compromised account monitoring. So we have over 700 billion compromised accounts within the platform that you can automatically monitor. You can hook it into Active Directory to automatically expire the passwords out if they get breached. There's the automated incident response that we were just talking about, where it'll actually go and collect the evidence, analyze it, respond to it. You know, it'll hook into things like Slack and say, hey, this machine just got breached. Do you want us to go and do instant response on it? And you can just respond saying yes, right? So it streamlines your operational security team. It also has native cyber threat intelligence that can be pulled in from the marketplace and just fed straight into your automation capabilities. And you can actually orchestrate security infrastructure. So, you know, when you think about, you know, organizations who need a SIEM solution, for example, you know, that can be like a 6 to 12 month project to actually go and research it, go and analyze it, you know, do tests and get that designed and implemented. Within Evolve, that's a capability from the SaaS marketplace where you can say, go and import a SIEM and orchestrate one for me, and you'll have a SIEM up and running in 10 minutes. You know, you can orchestrate a DNS sinkhole with integrated cyber threat intelligence feeds in 10 minutes. You can get internal and external pen testing up and running in 10 minutes. You can integrate native automated incident response to integrate into your environment within 10 minutes. You can deploy EDR agents across your whole environment automatically. So all of that just lets you speed up the time to improve your security and also just, reduce your security costs and maximize that security team that you've got.
That's amazing. And it's a really, truly innovative way of looking at things. So obviously as Australians are very proud, Ty, that you and the team are doing that. And well, one of the things I guess that segues into is, you know, we often hear at the moment, like the government's got a large multi-billion dollar initiative in cybersecurity. But at the same time, we're often fed this, that there's a skill shortage in the Australian market. What are your thoughts on this? Obviously you work with a lot of guys locally and internationally. Do you feel that's justified or do you think it's a bit of a beat up?
No, I absolutely think it's justified. There's a huge skills shortage and it's in security in general. But I think the skills shortage is more like I was saying, guys with those deep technical capabilities. The problem is when they get those technical capabilities, they become really expensive. And that means that they don't stay at those companies or those companies can't afford them anyway. So then even if they build those capabilities in our people, they're still not getting positioned here, or they get, you know, pinched by overseas. That might be a bit harder these days with COVID. Maybe that's a plus, but yeah, look, there's definitely a skills shortage, and, you know, I can see that, you know, they want to invest all of this money in upskilling and getting people through, you know, uni or TAFE degrees or certifications to get them into the market. The problem is that, you know, they still come in fresh. You know, like, you come out of uni, you think you're the man, but really everyone knows you're almost useless, right? So it takes you know, 5 to 10 years to actually get to that point where you're really respected and you understand what you're doing and you've got some of those deep technical capabilities. So if you look at, we've got that problem now and how long that's going to solve, that's a 10-year plan to increase the skills within the capabilities in the security industry in Australia. You know, compared to March when COVID kicked off and June when all of the security breaches started happening, you know, within 3 months, the whole landscape changed. You know, it's changes so fast. Like, we're not dealing with, you know, terrorist activities that, you know, the actual threat landscape is very, very slow. They know the threat actors, they can track them. You know, they're not just multiplying out. Whereas with, you know, cyber threats, you know, we're not talking about years of evolution of threats like you do with physical security threats. You're talking about hours or minutes or days or weeks, you know, and, you know, you could be, every year we see critical vulnerabilities and exploits come out and, you know, one day you go to bed and your whole organization is secure. The next day you wake up and you've got a notification of your phone of this, you know, new vulnerability that's been released in, you know, your Citrix server or your F5 or, you know, or your Mobile Iron. They were some of the recent ones that came out over the last year that suddenly everyone was getting hacked, you know, when you wake up in the morning. So, you know, you're talking about, a very different landscape. So when you're looking at, you know, training up, you know, the industry over a 10-year period or even a 5-year period, like, it is way too long. You know, over the next couple of years, you know, there is going to be major problems within this space. And I was attending a conference that we're a sponsor at this week. And one of the presenters was saying about, and interestingly, we were all saying the same thing, which was great because it justifies what, in my mind, that we're seeing the right thing as well. But also it's great to see us all on the same page. But one thing that was interesting was that, you know, when I was saying about these ransomware attacks where they were really infiltrated, he was saying the same sort of thing. But what he's also started to see was rather than just encrypting all of the servers and holding them for ransom, the failure with that technique with attackers is that a lot of companies have backups. So they basically just shoo the attacker away and they roll out their backups and they've got a clean environment again. And that still costs them a lot of money. It's not that it doesn't, but it means that they don't have to pay the ransom. What he's started to see is that the attackers actually break in, steal the data, encrypt the servers, hold them for ransom. If they don't pay, they then extort them to then say, we're going to release your data. Right, and that puts companies in a very, very difficult position because it's not like they can just roll out backups. Their data's out there and they can prove that, you know, provide samples of the data. And, you know, that puts it in a difficult situation because, you know, you're then in a trust position where you're like, it's a little bit different with these ransomware companies with the you know, help desk where they're trying to build that trust with an individual. when you're paying $6 million to, you know, not have your data leaked, and then you've got no promise or nothing to prove that they're not going to go and release it anyway, or they're not going to come back in 12 months and ask for another $6 million. It's going to put it in a very difficult position where companies are going to have to decide, well, do I pay this guy and then trust that he's not going to release it? Or do I not pay him and just suck up the business impact associated with this guy releasing it? Or girl, I should say, to be politically correct. So, you know, that's going to be really interesting coming down the line. And, you know, coming back to your point around skilling up the industry, I don't think we have that sort of time because, you know, these attacks are just going to evolve and evolve and evolve, hence the platform's called Evolve, you know, because it's going to have to keep changing. You know, those capabilities that teams are going to have are going to have to keep changing. So, you know, and that's why we actually created it as on-demand capabilities so that we can say, all right, well, you know, there's a new capability or there's a new attack technique that people need. All right, let's go and build that, release it in the marketplace and get that out to every customer on the platform. So that's, I think giving that upskilling is sort of what we're trying to do, but on demand, right? So you don't have to upskill your people. You just have them give them the capabilities that they need when they need it. So that's the approach that we're taking to try and sort of fill that gap.
That's awesome, because a lot of people I've talked to, especially young people starting out a career and want to go in security, it doesn't necessarily mean to have to go university. I've found by talking to them, but a lot of people do refresher courses over in India, ethical hacking courses, to get those skill sets once a year. They go for 3 or 4 weeks to find these really industry experts. How do you find that? Do you reckon it should be university mixed with some certification, mixed with some refresher courses? How does it work?
Look, to be honest, I don't, I mean, you know, I think university is definitely good to get that ground, you know, sort of knowledge. I mean, they didn't even offer security at my uni when I was at uni. So, and I started in security, strangely enough. Don't know how that happened, but anyway, but yeah, look, coming back to your point, I don't think that they need to have a degree. I don't even think they need to have necessarily the certifications. Like when I interview people, I don't look for whether they have a university degree. I do look at their certifications because it gives you a bit of a insight into, you know, what interests they've got and what skills they have done. Interestingly, if they have an excessive amount of certifications, it's almost a bad thing, because you know, some of these guys just go and do heaps of certifications, but they don't have any experience. You know, it's easy to go and get certifications because, funnily enough, the training companies, or, you know, who do the certifications, want you to pass the certification. So you do the training course, which basically they give you a wink and say, this might be in the exam, right? So that when you get to the exam, you pass, and lots of people are certified to build up that critical mass. So, you know, and there's good and pros and cons to the different certifications. You know, like a lot of people don't like things like CEH, but, you know, it's a good entry level certification for people who aren't in the industry yet, right? So, and it gives you a good wide coverage, like that, not necessarily that deep technical coverage. Whereas, like, as you go through your career, you want to specialize more in a particular area, and, you know, you end up doing something very specialized, like the shellcode lab, which, you know, is very niche. It's not going to get you a job because, you know, the chance of someone actually wanting to hire a shellcoder is pretty small, but it's more about getting that deep technical knowledge about how things work. But yeah, so look, I definitely don't think that you need it, but, you know, different organizations have, you know, tend to, you know, the big four tend to be a bit more bureaucratic around that sort of stuff. You know, I tend to jump on the phone and, you know, within the first 10 minutes, you tend to know if the guy knows what he's talking about or not. But, you know, I'll talk to them for an hour and a half, and, you know, very quickly, if they know the tools, they know the techniques, even the options to some of the tools, you know, if you go through those questions and they can answer some of these things and, you know, how they would break in, you know, I tend to not give them too much guidance. I'll say, hey, if I give you a network port on an internal network to a company, tell me how you would take over it. You know, and if they know how to do that, they will just, and they've done it lots of times because they're experienced, you know, then they will just unleash, you know, how to do that and all the wide variety of ways that you can actually break into a company. You know, whereas, you know, if you do a university degree and you'll get a whole bunch of certifications, it still doesn't necessarily mean that you know how to do it in the real world.
With, I guess, one of the other things as well, Ty, is around the ethical component of what you guys do is obviously, you know, you'll be engaged to perform, you know, a level maybe of penetration testing of certain access, which then gives you access to maybe specific data, which might be sensitive as well. So one of the things, I guess, a big one would be around trust of the people that you hired to not exploit that as well. I mean, I'm assuming there's some horror stories out there of, you know, you hear a lot of things about being in a black hat or white hat and all these sort of things too. So I imagine that crosses your mind a fair bit when you're looking at, you know, people for employment.
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny. You can pretty much tell the good guys from the bad guys. And, you know, some of them are just cannot help but want to tell you about it, right? Like they especially the younger guys, right, who, you know, they just want to, they don't have a lot of experience, but they've broken into a whole bunch of stuff, you know, companies when they shouldn't have. And yeah, just the number of times that they'll just blurt that sort of stuff out and it's like, all right, well, you cut. Others, they don't necessarily say it, but you can see it in, you know, little, you end up getting very tuned to little looks that they make, little sort of grins or, you know, a bit of, you can see they're thinking about some of the breaches that they've done, and you can pick up on some of that stuff, you know, and, but, you know, there's not a lot you can do. I mean, the one thing that I do is actually go and, the guys who I hire, I go and actually do profiling, like internet profiling. So, I mean, within Evolve, we actually can go and do automated reconnaissance. On typically on companies, but we use some of those techniques. I use some of those techniques to actually go and research the guys who you know we're hiring, and you know it's amazing some of the stuff that comes out when you go and research some of these guys. And you know, I mean, it's you've got to get a balance between guys who are interested in hacking and they're ethical. And you expect to see some sort of activity, not necessarily malicious activity, but you expect to see some sort of activity because you want them to be motivated, right, in the industry. And they're actually the really good guys, the ones who you find are out there and doing stuff and making their own tools and love it enough that they'll put the effort in to go and create tools or do presentations or whatever it is. Others, you'll go out and you'll find, you know, they're a web server owned by them that's hosting, you know, copies of malware and this sort of stuff. That again doesn't necessarily mean that that's bad. Maybe they're into malware analysis. And some of the guys I'll go back to and ask them and give them the chance to actually explain what that is. And you know, again, you know, some of them just can't help but say where it's from or what they've done with it. Others, you know, sort of demonstrate, you know, I've got a tool that I've been writing for malware analysis, and you know, that's a good thing.
Exposing themselves in a certain way. Now, mate, I've been watching a lot of movies. I've only got one monitor at home. How many more do I need before I can get into your industry? Should I go with two to hack or three? You know, I'm kind of confused there.
You're gonna have at least six, mate.
Six, yeah. Wall to wall.
Yeah, the double swordfish style.
That's it.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I don't know Halle Berry as a sidekick, but you know, that's all right. Yeah. I mean, so what's some of the next steps for you guys, Ty? Obviously, building out the Evolve platform. You're very obviously heavily involved in the local industry. Has COVID kind of slowed you guys down with presenting? I mean, I'm not a massive fan of, you know, the Zoom platform that much. I much would have rather the three of us went down to the Diggers and had this chat and recorded it down there. But I imagine for the immediate future, that's kind of the way things are still being run over video conference. And, you know, are there any plans to sort of get some of the local events back and running as soon as possible?
Look, everyone's still talking about virtual. I think that's going to be for a long time to come, at least the next year. So yeah, as I mentioned, we were involved in a conference earlier in the week, and that was a virtual conference with virtual booths and things like that. And I think that you know, the virtual conferences are actually, and the you know, obviously these companies have been investing in virtual, developing, you know, good looking virtual conferences to try and simulate actually going to a conference. Now I think that's going to become actually quite advanced to the point where, you know, you'll be able to virtually walk around, you know, the booths just like you would be as if you, you know, in at Black Hat in Vegas and go and talk to people. Whereas, you know, some of the conference platforms aren't there just yet. So I think that'll actually get better and better and actually, you know, start to just become, I think it'll just become a natural fit within conferences, even when there's a physical presence, like if we can start going to conferences again, because there is that social need. I think that virtual part to it is going to stay moving forward. And that's actually an opportunity for conference providers to actually then extend it out beyond those who, you know, don't want to spend a week and a half sending their guys over to Vegas to, you know, go and attend Black Hat or Def Con or B-Sides or whatever it is. But, you know, it's tough because the conference organizers also, you know, they need to get people in person if they're going to hold a physical event. So if you give the option of having, you know, a virtual event combined with a physical event, you then have a risk of not having enough physical people to have those booths and enough interest. And there's also then, well, we have to have someone man the virtual booth as well as the physical booth, and it starts to get quite complicated. So, but I think that it's going to stay moving forward. I think it'll be a while before, you know, a lot of that kicks off properly though. I think unfortunately we're stuck with Zoom and the video conferencing. You know, I just spent 2 days earlier this week, you know, manning a virtual booth, sitting here waiting, you know,
lucky you,
people to come up. Yeah. And it's not the same. Like we were gold sponsors over at Black Hat in USA in 2018, which was when we did our global launch of Evolve. And, you know, there was obviously a lot of people just walking backwards and forwards. And as soon as you finish with someone, I'd literally just pick someone walking past and say, "Hey, are you interested in security automation?" They go, "Oh yeah, I am actually." Yeah, all right, come over. And when you're in a virtual booth, there's no one to talk to. You basically have to wait for them to come in and turn their video on. All right. So it's got its challenges. I don't know how they'll get around that, but, I'll be keen when they start opening it up.
Absolutely. I mean, well, Zoom was a bit of hot water earlier, so I would imagine, you know, hosting a security conference online on a platform would be, yeah, open slather as well for a bit of fun for you guys. But, I won't let you incriminate yourself too much.
Yeah, I'm a bit busy these days too. My guys get all the fun poking around things like that these days.
Awesome. Well, Ty, it's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to have you on with us today. I mean, again, like I mentioned, you're one of the global leaders in this space, so we really appreciate you coming on board and giving your insights. We'll definitely have to have you back later on a bit of a security roundtable to give your thoughts with some of the industry leaders as well that we're planning to have on board. But behalf of myself and Michael, mate, thank you very much. For all of the listeners, we'll also be providing Ty's company's, which is Threat Intelligence, as well as LinkedIn profile. And definitely check out the Evolve platform. It truly is world-class. And if you are someone who does have an organization and not the security specializations that you think are required, jump on board and have a look. It looks like it's pretty easy to sign up, Ty. bang an account in and just go in and start browsing, really.
Sounds good. Thanks very much for having me, guys.
Awesome, mate. Pleasure.
Thank you. Cheers.